It's time now for the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review with Dr. Lou Campominosi, president of the Common Sense Campaign and adjunct professor of political science at Spring Hill College. This program is brought to you by Spriggs Enterprises, featuring the Shell gas stations on 98 in Daphne and in Malbus with a state-of-the-art car wash. Good morning, Dr. Lou.
So, folks, here we are yet again with another week of Biden and his problems. His problems are our problems, and our problem at this point is that you've got an individual who is dropping in the polls, which is good from my perspective. But why is he dropping in the polls? Well, one could argue that it might begin with the botched Afghanistan business. I think that's probably true. I hate to even use the word botched because that sort of suggests that it just went awry. It didn't go awry. They did this deliberately. The testimony coming out of the committees last week is that the military folks gave him their best advice. They basically said, keep about 2,500. And he basically didn't want to fool with that because guess what? He wanted to have his moment in the sun on September 11th, basically saying, we're done with Afghanistan. Well, yeah, we're done with it for right now, but we're not done with it. There's no way that we are going to be allowed or that the Taliban are going to be allowed to just rerun the whole 90s sequence, which led to bin Laden at that time planning and executing the 9/11 attack. If you don't think that they're going to be doing the same thing this time around, you're kidding yourself. So what is Biden's solution to that? Are we just going to let the Taliban, along with their allies now, Al-Qaeda, and they may be some problems with ISIS because of internal factions. Okay, got that. But the bottom line is, if they start doing the kinds of things that they did before, are we just going to sit by and let this happen? And you say, oh, no, he's already said we're going to have long-distance, over-the-horizon attacks on whatever happens. Well, just about everyone you talk to basically says over-the-horizon attacks are limited in nature. In the end, we're going to end up either putting boots on the ground back there or going back to seize Bagram so that we can actually maintain some sort of counterterrorism capability. So that it wasn't a botch. This was a deliberate attempt, and it's driving his polls down because the truth is coming out. The other part of this is that, let's see. They had 15,000 Haitians under the Del Rio Bridge. They're all gone now. 12,000 of them are somewhere in the country. Who knows where? And who knows what sort of medical state they're in? They've got all sorts of different diseases aside from COVID. But guess what, folks? The bad news is it ain't over with them. You've got 80,000 more, according to various sources. Laurie just looked askance at that. Yeah, Laura. I mean, 80,000 is the number that's moving up. Now, these folks aren't coming from Haiti, the island, okay? They have already been in various South American countries, Brazil particularly. But, hey, the border's open. Let's go to Ozitazuni. I mean, why not? I mean, so they're coming. Now, this is going to be a real issue in terms of will Texas and other places actually do the job of the feds? And we're going to create a constitutional crisis over this. How about inflation? That's a nice little problem. So you have all of these kinds of issues bubbling up in terms of national issues, which are not going away. And as I've suggested to you, the worse it gets for Biden, the better I think it is, even if it does have to hurt the country. But you know what? Lenin said this many moons ago. The worse it gets, the better it is for them. He was referring to the pre-Russian revolutionary period where, the Tsar was bogged down getting killed in World War I. The Germans had already created a situation where the Russian army was just about beaten, and they signed the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, and that was the end of it. So it was bad. Lenin understood that. We should understand it too, because what you're ending up getting here is a situation where it's about a year from now, November 20 of 2022, we're going to have another election. And if we can at least make some of the electoral reforms in some of these states that got stolen, then we may very well be able to take back the House and the Senate. We shall see. Meanwhile, back here in old Alabama, they just finished up with their special session. And so one of the things that I wanted to do this morning was to have Senator Chris Elliott come on and talk to us about this. Unfortunately, we are experiencing technical difficulties. So as soon as we get Senator Elliott on, we'll kick off with our discussion with Chris.
I have him on the line now.
Well, good news. Welcome back there, Senator Elliott.
Good morning, Chris. You're now on the air.
Good morning, Lori. Good morning, Dr. Lou.
Well, how are you doing?
I am doing well, sir. Glad to be back in Baldwin County after a week in Montgomery, for sure.
Yes, I'm quite sure that you're celebrating that that event being over. Well, I mean, listen, I really appreciate you coming on today because I think it's important that, and I'm sure you're going to be on the other talk shows, you know, the rest of the week trying to, you know, give a longer summary of what happened because, you know, we're kind of limited with time. But I did want to talk to you about, you know, just a couple of things here. One, the prison reform, and along with the question about some of these, not just prison reform, about how to get the prisons built, but some of the reforms associated with prisoners. And I think you voted against the parole part of this, and I think it's important for people to understand that. Second thing, I do want to try to get into this question about what's going on with redistricting, which, according to what Senator Albritton told me, you all will probably be going back fairly soon to get that taken care of. And then the last thing I wanted to talk to you about was this issue of, you know, health freedom and the vaccine mandates that are there, and the fact that you know, we're trying to protect our people from being forced to take a vaccine, and if they don't take a vaccine, they're going to lose their jobs. So let's talk first about this. And in fact, I wish I had a full hour today. Lori would indulge me if I gave her about $500, but nevertheless.
Twist my arm. I'll give you a few minutes.
We'll see. Okay. So let's talk first about the prison business, Chris. What's your sense of what was accomplished and what needs still to be done?
Well, Lou, the prison construction legislation that passed really started gaining momentum in the last legislative session when it became clear that the governor's prison lease program was likely to founder. And it did. It didn't make it, and it really shouldn't have made it. The price tag on that was about $3 billion over 30 years, and we weren't going to own the darn things at the end.
Yes, exactly.
And I was very much opposed to that. It did not finally die until after the legislative session was over, the regular session, and necessitated at that point a special session being called to deal with the prison construction issue. So legislators, including myself, met over the summer, long meetings and a lot of meetings over the summer to cobble together the plan that you saw pass and sign into law last week.
Yeah.
It is a conservative plan that builds two large prisons in phase one and it is essentially a bed replacement plan to replace a lot of the aging facilities that we have now.
Right.
And to put those prisoners in much safer conditions, both for themselves and especially for our corrections officers, than what they're in now. Lou, what they're in right now is a dormitory-style setting, and I've been in these prisons. I was in one latest last week, where you have these prisoners stacked in there like cordwood, and they are violent to begin with.
Right.
And then we put them in a violent, un-air-conditioned facility stacked on top of each other, and it really is just a powder keg. And all too often it goes off. We do not have, in those types of settings, the facilities to control those prisoners or the officers to control those prisoners, and it oftentimes gets out of hand. We are shifting the ratio of dorm beds to cells, if you will, mm-hmm. in favor of many more cells instead of these dormitory-style settings. That's gonna allow us to control that population a whole lot better for their own good, and especially for the good of our officers that are trying to work there. And that's going to solve a lot of our prison staffing issues as well.
Right.
Right now, we just don't have a safe workplace for them, and they're going to be in a safer workplace. Let's talk about the details of the plan. Cost-wise, we're at about $1.2 billion as opposed to the $3 billion the governor proposed. That breaks down at about $785 million that could be borrowed, with some of the cheapest money we've seen around in my lifetime and likely will ever see in my lifetime. The part I'm particularly proud of, though, is that over $150 million of it is going to be built out of cash. That's money that we have received in revenues at the state that we didn't budget and didn't do it on purpose because we wanted to be conservative at our revenue projections. Now, how often can you say that about government?
Well, that's
and
true.
Then on top of that, about $400 million from the American Rescue Plan money, that is money that's coming from the feds to account for unrealized revenue due to the pandemic. It is not earmarked. It's the uses of it are pretty wide and would have gone to the general fund anyway. This is an expenditure coming up that we knew we were going to have. So you have the government, the state, going into this, building an awfully lot of this out of cash as opposed to borrowing, and then admittedly borrowing the rest of it, but at a very low interest rate.
Right.
And then the total cost of the project being under half of what the governor's program was to begin with.
Let me just ask you a couple of questions. Let's just go back to the prison building thing. One of the arguments against what that Ivy was doing was that she was not really creating a solution to the numbers that were there. In fact, she had shrunk it. So did you address this so that there is enough space? And I think it's perfect, a good idea to get away from the dormitory business with more cells. But did you really address the shortage that was going to be there if Ivy's plan had gone through?
We did, and we did it in a phased approach. So you have the first phase that is, again, essentially a replacement program, if you will, bed replacement program, to 4,000 facility, 4,000 bed facilities. And what, Lou, what we're going to do is we're going to take prisons offline as these prisons come online, okay? Then there is a phase two and a phase three to this plan. Phase two has identified already prisons that need to close and additional construction that likely will need to take place. And then phase three is essentially a study by a commission to go forward and fine-tune additional beds or lack of additional beds that need from that point. Now, the important thing to note here is that our prison population calculations and numbers right now are just weird. There's no other way to put it. They're abnormal. We've got COVID that's causing a lot of these prisoners to be kept in county jails. DOC's not moving them into prison facilities. And there are huge discrepancies between what DOC is saying and what the counties are saying are housed in county jails, almost a 50% discrepancy. And frankly, Lou, I haven't been able to nail down the real number. And on top of that, you've got all these parole issues and things of that nature that are skewing the numbers. We've got to let all of that settle down, in my opinion, and so we can get our hands around what we truly need in as far as number of beds. So okay. I think we're moving forward on addressing a lot of the DOJ issues and a lot of the safety issues. We've put in place a phase two and a phase three to evaluate as we get further down the road on what we really need, but we're not overbuilding. We're planning on making sure we look at what this settles down, this prison population number settles down to be, and then have the mechanism in place to continue building as we need, but right. Not more than we need.
Well, I mean, my next question on that was the DOG business. Will this pass muster? I mean, that's been the critical factor driving all of this. So are you pretty sure that, given what the people, the experts are telling you, that the DOJ is going to be fairly satisfied with this?
I am. I think that when you look at what we're doing from a construction standpoint to improve both prisoner and officer safety and the ability to control those prisoners in cells as opposed to in these dormitory facilities, and the addition, frankly, of some needed rehabilitation-type programs in prison, I think the DOJ is going to be very satisfied with what we're doing here.
Okay, well, we'll keep our fingers crossed.
It's not an inexpensive endeavor that we're undertaking here, but it is much less inexpensive than the Department of Justice coming in and taking over,
sure.
Or worse, Lou, the Department of Justice mandating release of violent prisoners.
Okay, let me ask you a funding question, okay? This issue about using the CARES Act, you know, what I've been able to see is that there's still some question about how fungible all of this is for things other than the CARES Act's intention. So are y'all pretty clear that you're going to be able to use this? And, of course, if the answer is yes, then I think you still have about $1.3 billion left. My next question is, are you going to be able to try to use some of that for the I-10 bridge project? I know that's separate from what we're talking about, but let's face it, that is a major issue down here.
Oh, it is, and there's no question about it. Luke, to answer the first part of your question, I have very little doubt that we are going to be able to successfully use the $400 million that's been appropriated from the CARES Act funding for this prison construction project. Again, that funding is for essentially revenue replacement, lost revenue replacement that would have otherwise gone to the general fund, that would have otherwise been used for essentially prison. So I do not have, I don't have any doubt really that that's going to pass muster. The balance of the CARES Act money has more restrictions on it. This was the unrestricted portion. The balance has much more restrictions on it, that $1.2, $1.3 billion that remains.
Yeah.
And I think it would be very difficult to use that portion of the funding for the I-10 bridge. And, Lou, as you well know, even if that was the case, it would be very difficult for my many, many colleagues that live north of here to allocate that money for that purpose.
Yes, je comprends that one. No problem for sure. So here we are then. You know, I do appreciate, you know, your synopsis of what went on with that. Let me just ask you this, though. This prison reform also had another part of it there where you voted no on, as I understand it, providing early release for quote-unquote nonviolent prisoners, and they're supposed to have electronic devices to watch over them and see where they are, I guess. But as I understood it from listening to Jeff Poor's show this morning, there was an officer killed by one of these individuals who's on electronic device, paroled early. And so we're back to square one with, what are they really trying to do here? And since this has already passed, do you think it's going to come up in January to undo that?
Lou, I was very disappointed about the reform measure that did pass. You know, the legislature is about compromise and finding middle ground. I think that the House and Senate leadership and the governor were trying to find some middle ground with Democrats and, frankly, with each other about these reform measures. I know there were probably 8 or 10 reform measures when we started. That was whittled down to 4 very quickly. Then the 2, really, that made the governor's call, and then the House did not pass one of them at all, leaving just 1. So if you're looking at it from a compromise standpoint, I guess we got a little bit closer. But at the end of the day, Luke, we're still talking about letting dangerous criminals out early. And let's be clear about what this is. This was a measure that lets criminals who are at the end of their sentence, inmates who are at the end of their sentence, out a year or 6 months early, again, with an electronic monitor. By the way, the bill for that's about $4 million, and we haven't appropriated that yet, so it comes with a price tag. But letting those folks out earlier while we still have some control over them, that was my colleague's argument, is we can still monitor them, we can still help them assimilate. My issue is, you don't get to end the sentence unless you're not just bad before you go to prison, but you're bad when you're in prison. In order to actually stay in an Alabama prison all the way to the end without getting paroled or released for good behavior, you got to be a bad guy in prison too. So now we're not just letting out bad guys who were bad guys before they were in prison, but we're letting bad guys out that were bad guys the whole time they were in prison. And I just couldn't stomach that.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, as you point out, you know, I watched my colleagues over the weekend, you know, post on social media that they were heartbroken and saddened by the death of a police officer and the wounding of another one. by a man who was let out of prison early. While on
exactly.
the day, they voted to let violent criminals out of jail early. And I just, I can't reconcile that in my head or my heart, and that's why I voted no.
Well, I mean, it's back to good intentions and bad consequences, you know, and I think that, you know, it's part and parcel of the liberal agenda, and I know you have compromises that you have to make, but I think, you know, this kind of outcome just may very well lead to you all pushing hard to strike it out and start again in January. So, but let's quickly move on to our next two topics. One is this redistricting, and without going into too much detail, Do you have a sense of when the session is going to start again, and what are the big issues for you facing redistricting?
I expect that the redistricting special session will start the last week in October
uh-huh.
and likely run into the very beginning of November. All, of course, as you know, school board districts, state school board districts, all of the congressional districts, and all 105 House seats and 35 Senate seats will be redrawn in the state as is required by the Constitution. So we're going to do that, and we're in that process. Baldwin County is in the unique position. Of course, everybody knows about our growth, but when you get down to the granular level of House and Senate districts, we have the most overpopulated House district, which is currently represented by Steve McMillan in the south end of the county, and the most overpopulated Senate district, which I have the pleasure of representing in the state. Both of those are right here in Baldwin County.
Mm-hmm.
So those districts geographically are going to have to shrink significantly, and from a demographic standpoint are going to have to hemorrhage folks in order to get back within what is mandated
right.
For us to be from a size.
Well, that's certainly for a topic for another discussion. But you know, from the perspective of people like us sitting here watching it, is there anything in particular, especially on the school board business? Because you know, monkeying around with the school board districts is something that a lot of people are very concerned about. So, what is your sense of that?
I think that coastal Alabama is an anomaly. Oftentimes that works against us, but when it comes to redistricting, it kind of works in our favor. When I look at things statewide, they tend to want to isolate us and put us off to the side, and when it comes to protecting our turf as far as a school board district, I'm not sure that's a bad thing. So this may be one instance where they say, give them a school board district, don't mess with them, leave those jokers down in South Alabama alone, and
yeah.
I think that's what's going to happen. From a congressional standpoint, I think that's what's going to happen from a school board standpoint. But I'm not sure. You know, you never know with the numbers. A lot of it's demographic-based, and they'll be taking all of that into account when they make those decisions.
Right. Okay. All right. Next thing, I sent you over the weekend this question about what one of these new activist groups is working on, health freedom in Alabama. The question about protecting individual workers from employer mandates for getting the vaccine, what is your general sense of this? And I know I've talked to Senator Albritton about it. He is in favor of some sort of legislation, and I haven't had a chance to talk to you about it, but I have sent you some background information on it. I know that what we'd like to see and what we think should be done is to propose this during the next special session, because we're already seeing people who are losing their jobs. You saw 150 healthcare workers in Texas a couple of months ago go through this. We've had all sorts of emails from folks here that are losing their jobs. So the question is it possible for you to push this hard enough to get colleagues of yours to, I guess, force the governor, and we're going to try to put pressure on her, but to force this into this next redistricting session?
You know, Lou, the proof is in the pudding, and we're going to see. I will tell you, first of all, I doubt that the governor will place this in the call for the next special session. I would be fine with it if she does, but I doubt that she will. You know, she could handle a lot of this through executive order if she wanted to. She certainly has not had a problem issuing executive orders regarding the pandemic so far. She could certainly do it again. But she's not had the, shown that she's interested in doing that, unfortunately. That means it's incumbent upon the legislature to do so in January. Of course, last regular session, we were able to get a vaccine mandate, or excuse me, a vaccine passport bill passed. That bill was a compromise in and of itself, and I think what we have seen since its passage is that the intent really needs to be more clearly defined, and that legislation in being the compromise it was really showed just how much it doesn't cover, and we need to get back in there and shore some of that up. Now, that provides very little comfort to the folks that are being told they have to get a vaccine right now or lose their job.
Yeah, exactly.
I am well aware of that. Yeah. I'm just trying to answer you as directly as I can and tell you that I do not think there's going to be help on the way from the governor between now and when the legislature gets back into regular session and can kind of choose its own destiny, which happens in January.
Right.
The one bright spot that I am seeing is the good old market forces that are at play. And I am seeing employers noticing that there are employees standing up to vaccine mandates and saying, I'm not doing this. Fire me if you want to. And the employers are making the conscious decision to not require vaccine mandates because they know they will have a huge workforce shortage if they do.
And well, I mean, they already have a workforce. There's already a workforce shortage because of what Biden is doing. But
that's at least some good news.
Yeah, but you see, I think one of the things, let me just ask you this, on the passport bill that you all passed in the Senate, I thought you were one of the chief proponents of that. Is that correct?
I certainly was. It's not my bill, and I didn't author it. Senator Orr did a lot of work on that, but I was very much in support of it.
Okay. So, I mean, conceivably, people who are inclined along those lines should be willing to take the present bill, I think it's H.R. 2, Wharton in the House has taken, and he's got 23 co-sponsors. Is it possible for you to work with Wharton and do the same thing in the Senate and just see what we can do and put some pressure on Ivy?
It is, and Lou, I'll tell you that short of the governor taking action before January, that is something I am working with to try to find a way to get a piece of legislation like that through. Obviously, the compromise on the passport bill was to limit it to government entities. I think that, and you've heard, of course, that the business community pushed back on expansion of that very much further. I try to find a way to get things passed as opposed to just throwing things out there that may or may not work, and I will continue to work towards that between now and January to see if we can figure out a way to actually get some protection for workers enacted into law as opposed to just talking about it.
Right. Let's just assume for a second that the grassroots or some other, by other means, the governor decides to come around, okay? Is it possible then for you to be able to be ready for a bill such as Wharton's bill and start working on it now with the senators that who would be inclined to do it if they supported the vaccine passport bill?
Absolutely, and we are working on that now, no question about it.
Okay.
This topic is one that everybody is very well aware of. The grassroots groups like yourself have certainly, and your groups have made clear that this is something you want action on, and we are listening, no question about it, and that's being worked on right now. I'd love for the governor to take some action in the interim, but failing that, I would expect in January for there to be movement on
right.
this issue.
Let's just tease this out a little bit, Chris. I know that you and Lieutenant Governor are close. Is it possible for you to push on him and for us? I'll start pushing on him too, but to get him to go to the governor and say, look, we can't let these things happen without intervening on behalf of our citizens.
I think that's a good idea, and I think you probably would find a willing, a listener there in the lieutenant governor, he's certainly sympathetic to things that I bring to him, and I know that Trump's a good principled guy. So I would imagine you would find a willing listener there, and would encourage you to contact him.
Okay. Can I just ask you to do the same thing? We are going to do it too at this end, but we'll go ahead and count on a couple of the senators to go and do the same thing that we're going to try to do. All right?
Yes, sir.
All right. Okay, so I'm going to have you back with redistricting and the I-10 bridge. You know, all of this stuff, there's a big kumbaya moment down here with the two MPOs, but once again, we seem to be stuck as to what Aldott's doing and what Cooper's doing, and I know that Cooper is a dirty word for you, but somehow it seems to me that we've got to come to an agreement about upping the amount of money that the state is going to kick into this, and we'll see where it goes. But you're still on that transportation committee now, aren't you?
I am indeed, absolutely. And you know, Lou, the state certainly has some financial restrictions on it, but it's a matter of priorities, and it always has been.
Right.
The governor's proposed spending $2 billion on the widening of Highway 45 going up from Thomasville up to Tuscaloosa, and you got to wonder, is that really the best way to spend that kind of money, or would it be better for our economy, the state's economy, the port, and everything else going on in coastal Alabama to spend that money on a bridge and be done with it?
Well, weren't you all supposed to come up with some sort of a bill that was going to inject more supervision over this whole prioritization process with ALDOT?
There is, and that was part of the gas tax legislation that was passed.
Yeah.
We run into constitutional issues and separation of powers issues there.
Uh-huh.
Would love to have much more authority over what the executive does, but the Constitution lays out some pretty specific guidelines there, if you will, or guardrails. And unfortunately, a lot of that prioritization is still in the hands of the executive branch and the governor.
Well, the only thing we can do is elect somebody else other than Ivy. That's what I'm saying. You don't have to comment on that. That's okay. We understand. Look, Chris, I really appreciate you coming on today. Great update, informative, and as always, and we'll certainly stay in touch on these other issues, okay?
Thanks, Lou. I appreciate it. You and Lori have a great day.
Thank you. Senator Chris Elliott.
Good morning. All right, folks. Boy, that went fast.
It did.
You know, it is critical for us, and you know, to put pressure on the governor. And I mean, we've said this all along, that she is who she is, and she has never been a friend of the conservative movement. Okay, whether it's Common Core, whether it's the gas tax, whether it's Amendment 1, the history isn't there. But I do think at this particular juncture, it's the time for us to raise our voices and start calling, and that's what we're going to do, and I will send an action alert to Lori so she can put it out through her folks. We'll put it out through the state. I know that the Health Freedom folks are going to do the same thing. We're going to motivate the state to wake her up to do the right thing now and not wait until more people lose their jobs over this damn vaccine. That's the bottom line. So for all of y'all who are listening, I appreciate your time. We'll be back next week, hopefully, God willing. The sun don't rise or whatever that saying goes. But please stay engaged. And, let me just say this. If you're free tonight, Congressman Jerry Carl is going to be speaking at our planning committee meeting at the original Oyster House tonight on the Causeway at 6 p.m. We've had big crowds there, so if you want to go, please get there early. We'll see how the seating goes. But last time we had like 75 people.
Wow.
Yeah. Lori says, wow, but it's too much. We've got to figure a better way out. And I think what we're going to do is try to live stream this. So if you don't get a seat in the Delta Room, you can sit there and have a great original oyster food, house food, and watch what's going on your phone. So there we have, folks. Y'all take care. God bless. Bye.
Thank you. And that will be tonight, Monday, October 4th. I say that because due to technical difficulties, about the first half of this program was not heard on the air or online. So we're going to replay this show, Dr. Lou, Wednesday, this week, Wednesday at 10.05 a.m. For those that may have missed the first half. In addition to that, we always post the show at WABF1480.com.
Okay. Thanks, Laura. Take care.
You're welcome. You've been listening to the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review with Dr. Lou Campomenosi, president of the Common Sense Campaign and adjunct professor of political science at Spring Hill College. This program is paid for by Spriggs Enterprises, featuring the Shell gas stations on 98 in Daphne and the state-of-the-art car wash Shell gas station in Malbus. We now resume regular programming, WABF.
I knew a man, Bojangles, and he danced for you in worn-out shoes.